Okay, this is the 11th chapter from our book, Letting Go, that we're going to address tonight. And the name of the chapter is Not What You Do, But Who Does It. Some people worship science, and some people worship money. Some people worship culture. Some people worship an unseen God. Some people worship food. Some people worship books. Of course, I could go on and on and on, because every word that I could say, and it represents something that someone somewhere is obsessed with. Worship, and we all worship, some of us, many of those, not just one, but many of those items I just mentioned. And we worship, to worship something means that it's an object of belief. Right, we believe that it is going to give us something that we either feel we need or we don't already have. Therefore, we pay homage to it. We do its bidding in our lives. We believe in it. If you add all these beliefs up together, relating to family and work and Aikido and all those other aspects of your life that make up our lives, that is the structure that you are. That belief structure is your personality. And when we are operating out of a belief structure, we are basically being run by that belief. It's running us. We aren't living life. That aspect of our structure is running us. So this isn't to say that any aspect of any kind of action or any kind of engagement is right or wrong. It's not about that. It's about recognizing what part of you is engaged. Therefore, the title of the chapter, Not What We Do, But Who Does It. Well, I'll read a little from the book. Someone asked me to point out what page I was on. This is 132. The one point is the gateway between Shoga and Taiga, between the relative and the absolute states of mind. If you were to cut your stomach open and look for the one point, you would not find it. The physical place of one point is only a convenient reference point. But reference to what? As long as we are speaking about a universe with time and space, we have to have a center of that. And here we have a center that both is the center of the time and space universe and at the same time transcends that universe. So if we are to see the whole picture or know who we are, we must clearly establish our point of connection. That will do it. So we say, keep one point. Know your relative condition well and then transcend that time and space being. Get beyond your relative mind. Then when you touch your hands to the piano keys, or you cut the vegetable, or you even turn on the car engine, the whole quality of life is transcended. Life moves then from just the thing itself to something luminously glowing with the source. This changes the quality of everything. You know that when someone is really tired, depressed, and negative, it is difficult to see their beauty in any way. But when you see the same person at another time, when they are happy and fresh, wow, what a huge difference it makes. This is what we mean by being full of ki. It is a very natural condition, and everyone already has experienced it. Yesterday when I was being interviewed, the interviewer asked me what was the most important thing Suzuki-sensei taught me. I told him that the most important thing he taught me was how to handle a difficult situation with equanimity. In other words, when everything is falling apart around you, when the most cherished thing is being taken from you right before your eyes, do you fall apart and add to the problem? This only adds insult to injury, as we say. You lose everything if you do that. It is never a question of what you deserve or don't deserve. That is taking it personally. You have to forget all of that. The selfish mind sees things that way, but that is not the truth. To be living in the truth is to not have preference in exactly this way. This is what we call equanimity. The condition that we find is the condition that is. It is happening, and we cannot change it or avoid it. Handling a situation with equanimity means you don't care to gain or lose. You just stay right in it, because that's what's happening to you. Keep one point means to look at everything from the center of the universe, to dwell in the center of the universe. Look from a position of equanimity, and you will always have equanimity. If you look from a position of relative concern, call it shame or fear or guilt or even relief, all that stuff is relative garbage that the society around us sells. You don't have to follow that. Your commitment to the center of the universe, which I say is your commitment to the truth, tells what kind of human being you actually are. And we don't know until times get tough what kind of human being we are. Do you fold up or do you stay with it? You might as well stay with it because there is really nothing else to do. Oh, it seems like there are some alternatives, but those are imaginary options. Always it is what is right in front of you. And if you do succeed in avoiding it, then it will just return later, but be much more difficult to deal with. Let's remember that the reason we are here is not to make money, babies, or mischief. We do that while we are here, it's true, but that is not necessarily why we are here. We are here to wake up. We are here to see and know the nature of this human condition. That is the purpose of being human. As long as we remember that, we will always have equanimity, because we will see everything that comes along is just helping us to do that very thing, to wake up to our purpose. That is the reason for every single thing that we come upon. It's not as obvious sometimes as me sitting here telling you this, but it is so. It is just easy to forget. End quote. In the past several sessions we've had, a similar question has come up over and over again. There's a concern, there's a view, there's a perspective that can be problematic. And that is that there is the question of, well, should I be, if what counts is who does it, not what we do, then obviously it's important who acts. And many people have discerned from that, or discriminated from that, that, well, it must be that I need to be the taiga person, not the shoga person. Taiga and shoga is sort of like emptiness and form. Or mind and body. Emptiness and form, mind and body, same thing. Mind is the space here. A body is the thoughts, sensations, and emotions. In other words, experience is body. When we say body, we're not talking about this over here, this you people, or this building. This is not form. That's why it's so difficult to understand when we say form is emptiness and emptiness is form, and form is not other than emptiness and emptiness is not other than form. I've mentioned before, there is no separation between awareness and experience. There's no separation between the space in which experience takes place and the experience itself. There's no difference between mind and body. Because we see these things as different, we have a sense of separation. So then when we hear something like that, like that phrase, it's not important what you do, but who does it, we think, okay, then I have to be the taiga guy, be the emptiness guy. I have to be the. But actually, taiga is all of it. Mind is all of it. We don't look up in the sky and see the clouds floating by and say, well, there's the sky, well, except for those clouds. It's all the sky. There's clouds floating by, and there's birds flying in it, and planes flying in it, and balloons going up in it. But the sky doesn't have a care what's in it. There's no separation. It makes no distinction like that. Completely open and accepting. Completely this. This is open mind. Mind like the sky. Just a metaphor, of course. This is all of this that we have in every moment of our life. On the other hand, if we are acting out of a belief structure that has been conditioned into us by our parents or society or by some teacher or our friends, then we're being led and run by that conditioned belief. We're just reacting according to how that is. If someone agrees with that belief, we like them. And they are perforce our friend, even though they might not have our best interest in mind. And if someone does not agree with our beliefs, they are not our friend and we don't trust them, even though they might have our best interest in mind. We are terrible judges. We don't know what's going on around us when we're caught up in these structures. We call this being run by a pattern, you know? That's why I say, what you do is not so important. You know? What's important is who you are. And I don't mean by that you should be something. Okay, so that's sort of the theme of this chapter. Well, it's the theme of the whole book, isn't it? But it's the theme of this chapter's take on it. So, any comments, questions?
When you were talking about the sky, it reminded me when I was trekking in the Himalayas, and they were very treacherous paths, and I was really looking at the ground so that I wouldn't fall over the cliff. And my friend said, "You're missing the whole experience." And But it was quite a stretch to open up and look at the sky, look at the mountains, and trust that my feet would not go off the cliff. So, but that small, fearful, contracted view, you know, that, you know, missing.
Missing the whole point of being there.
Of being there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because I'm only seeing that part in front of my feet.
Yeah.
And not the magnificence.
Exactly. And that's how we are in our everyday life, is what you're saying. And that's why we have meditation. So meditation is when you stop on the path and don't risk your life and enjoy the sky. And when you get maybe more experienced, you can walk and enjoy the sky. But it's not easy to do right off. So we practice meditation and enjoyment so that we see that there is this wonderful openness to experience and enjoy, and then gradually it's a part of our, it becomes more and more a part of our everyday life. Good point.
Well, one other thing, when you were talking about worship initially, you seemed to be relating it to some kind of obsession or attachment to the object of your...
I related it to belief.
Yeah.
So worshiping, we worship something because we believe that it has something to offer us that we don't already have.
That in the spiritual community that I lived in, the work that we did was called our worship. And so no matter what we did, it was bringing a posture of kind of devotion and awakeness to that. You know, whether you were cleaning the toilet or doing the bookkeeping.
Right. Well, I hope you understand from what I said that it's not the thing. It's not the thing that you're doing, but who does it? I think I said that. For instance, some of us, in fact, I'm sure all of us, to some degree or other, but maybe in the local Japanese community even more, the kids are taught their sense of responsibility, and when the parents are, you know, older, they feel a tremendous obligation or responsibility or duty to take care of them, right? And if they don't do that, they feel guilty. If they do that, they feel rewarded. They feel they have succeeded. They have fulfilled their duty. They've fulfilled their responsibility. They feel good about themselves. But those are two sides of the same coin. So I'm not saying don't take care of your parents, but do it without escaping from the guilt or chasing after the reward. So any kind of worship, any kind of action, I mean, let's face it, whatever we do, we think we're going to get something out of it, that's why we do it. So your teacher basically was saying, recognize that everything you're doing is that. But don't do it to get a reward. And don't do it to run away from the punishment or guilt or the chagrin of others that might come from not doing it, from shirking it. So this is what I was calling equanimity. In other words, it's just being here and responding with a fullness and alertness and a presence, whatever it is that comes up that's needed, without preference. Okay.
You know, of course the whole book is pretty much the same subject, actually, right? So, try to grasp it every day, pretty much, but you know, like when we're doing it in key class, the double lift. I'm the biggest.
Two people lifting you.
So I think of everything, boom, I go right up. I think, okay, 1 point, boom, I go right up. So, you know, what? Like, I guess I'm going for a goal, but I don't want to say I'm doing that, but.
I'm going for a goal, but I don't want to say I'm doing that.
You know, I mean. But yeah, it's like, okay, this. And then I'm in dead relaxation, I guess, trying to relax too much. What is this? There's no answer.
Yeah. So what does frustration come from?
From attachment to...
Well, no, without the jargon.
Yeah.
When you feel frustrated, what just happened?
Well, it's an experience of failing.
Failing. Yeah. You didn't get what you wanted.
Right.
You didn't succeed at whatever you were trying to do. That's what frustration is. I don't seem to be able to do this thing. Implied in that is the desire for success.
Right.
And the teaching in key class, in terms of key tests, is if you desire to succeed, that alone is the other side of the fear of failing coin, and that is failing the key test. The key test is that itself. It's not about physically being lifted or not. That's just an indication to us that what state our mind is in. What happens with the body tells us what state our mind was truly in. We can't fool ourselves. That's why we like key tests, because it reveals what's really going on with us.
Yes.
Yes.
But I know what you're saying, but it's so hard to write to me. It's because you think you're there, but you really ain't.
That's the wonderful thing about key tests. Is you get to see exactly where you are.
Yeah. And I guess it just comes with more sitting, because definitely that's what I'm finding out, then. It's a key to a lot of things.
Letting go is the name of the book. What are we letting go of? We're letting go of that need to succeed, that fear to fail. That's equanimity. That's why I said, that's the thing, the one thing, if I were to pick out, of course Suzuki-sensei taught me many things, lots of different teachings, but the core that he was always repeating to me, always watching me, always talking to me about, always demonstrating for me. Although he never used the word equanimity. That's a word I learned later that I realized, that's this. No preference to win or lose. That's true confidence. Not confidence to win. That's why I was doing that in the key class. I didn't want people to identify confidence with succeeding. Because the whole problem is succeeding and failing. The drive to succeed and the fear to fail.
Right.
So passing key test is beyond success or failure. It's completely beside the point.
Yeah.
So that's what we say, it's what matters is not what you do. Who does it doesn't mean there is someone there. We can go into that later. I was sitting in the office talking to someone today at the meeting, and she said, well, this is kind of like going jogging. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, I don't like to do it. Ahead of time, I resist it. And in the beginning, it's hard to get going. But once I get going, I love it. And I think, why don't I do this every day? Kind of like asking a question. I don't want you to feel that, the subject is so esoteric or so challenging that whatever you would ask is not going to be important or would be a stupid question or something,
Since I often have resistance to asking questions because it seems like there's always the same answer. Heard the answer, so
I'm just not
going to figure it out on my own.
Oh, well, maybe I need to be more clever about wording the answer in more entertaining ways.
No, I think that the continuum, please, having the answer being the same thing, just to explain my own reasons why. When I first started training, I had, of course, a lot of ideas about what I knew in the world. And every time that I would ask you a question, I felt as though my foot was immediately placed in my mouth. And so for a few years then, I stopped asking questions because I felt that it was part of the training that I just come and just experience and just do to find the answers of what I was really to the questions that I had.
And now?
And now?
That you're free to ask questions?
That I'm freer to ask questions. I really try to put a lot more thought into them before I verbalize them. Because I think that I still are learning that my training is about me finding the experience that you're teaching us. And we can verbalize it in 3 million infinite numbers of ways.
Mm-hmm.
But the verbalization, it feels like a trap at times.
Yeah. Well, what's the value of the teaching for you? What's the value of the practice?
The value of the practice is not being disturbed by things and not being disturbed or disturbing others.
And are you having that experience?
I had that experience. It's not a consistent experience for me. It's not the way my experience always is. But I certainly recognize how my training has helped me see easier when I stray from that.
Okay.
Sincerely, I deal with a lot of people whose concern is, how am I doing?
You're in your psychology work?
In my work, correct. And
whose concern is, how am I doing?
Yeah, everyone asks, how am I doing? You know, and I know from my own practice that if I'm sitting on Friday night and I'm looking at how I'm doing, it doesn't work so well for me. I believe that as soon as we get identified with that lag mechanism that we're dragging around, which is, how am I doing? As soon as you ask a question, you're already referencing something that's no longer existing, not happening. You're dragging that around. But the other people around us can see us and have much more direct experience of ourselves than we do. Except if we let go of that mechanism and we join with them, that we move together.
With this?
Yeah, we are doing this together. So the title of the chapter is, you know, who is doing it? Is it we are doing it? Always? We are always doing this?
Who's we? So you can't know. In the same way that you can't find anything when you go looking for I within yourself, you can presume that others also cannot. And if you ask them, they will respond affirmatively. But you can't know that about them. Only they can, each of us only can know that ourselves. I'm not suggesting that when we say, What's important is who does it, that I or we do it. I'm not suggesting that anyone as long as there's that separation, what did you call it, that loop? That lag mechanism. As long as there's that separation between ourself and our experience, right? Which places us a little bit away from our current moment experience. Whereas everyone else may be able to experience us now, we're, you explained, not quite experiencing us right now, but a little bit of a lag behind. We're sort of self-referencing. We're sort of considering, looking at, observing, watching. That's always off time. But what if you don't do that at all? Then you're just on time. There's just this. Something happens, it just... The response is just there. Someone attacks. Boom, boom. It's over. This is Aikido. No ideas about it. And to be in this condition, here, right now, we have to let go of any sense of a self doing something. As long as we have that sense of I am doing something, there's a separation between I and the something.
The separation has to mean something. Because I think about our vision. Okay, we have each one of us is looking at you, seeing one thing. Well, each one of us is processing two images simultaneously that make us believe that we see one thing. There's a separation. We have a split in our vision, in our hearing. It's split in time. What's it for? Is it for a sense of depth? Is this separation itself, we look for meaning in that, and then it gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, and smaller until there's...
Never becomes zero. Doesn't
so
work
means
that way.
And it's this.
It just means that we're not present. We are not living life. We are living our idea of life. That's what all those belief structures do to us. Because everything that happens has to be compared against a belief structure to see if it's safe, if it's good, if it's the right thing to do, to say, to think, to feel, to do.
Right. Keeps
That's what
eaten,
makes us separate.
Right? Keeps it from being eaten.
We don't have to think about anything to keep from getting eaten. You hear a lion, you get your ass out of there. That's a response. A healthy response. Yeah, it's we live in a world in which story rules. That's what we were talking about in the last session. The story is that reflection on the moment, what everybody is living, their own reflection on the moment, which is a very safe place to be, right? Because you're not out on the growing tip, you're not in the moment. You're back in the knowing body, the belief body. You're back in here. And you have a whole story about what happened, and then you go to someone and you share the story. And our whole culture, magazines and TV and movies and radio and social interaction is all built on that self-referencing, which builds all the stories. So those people that come to you and say, how am I doing, doc? Tell them next time you come, please come in and sit down and say, who am I? And then at least gives you something
I have a business to run, too.
To work so with.
That tends to drive people out the door sometimes.
You have a what?
Business to run sometimes.
His clientele.
Oh.
You have to scare them off.
Oh, you want to keep them. Oh, sorry.
Well, that's the difference.
I have to put a little bait out for it.
The who am I question is spiritual work.
Yeah, like I can chase people away, but he can't afford to.
They're coming with a problem. And they want him to fix it.
Yeah.
Or help them fix it.
Well, fundamentally, I think maybe this is what you're saying, yeah. But the difference between psychotherapy and spiritual work is psychotherapy is dealing with minimizing
suffering.
Spiritual work is dealing only with ending suffering. No minimizing. So anything that you might do to make yourself feel better about yourself would be, in fact, the problem. Whereas, correct me if I'm wrong, and I shouldn't really be talking about this in front of a psychotherapist, but and I know a few, and that's generally what they're engaged in, is trying to help their patients feel better about themselves and have a more healthy outlook on life, and all of which is good and fine. It's a different, a little different approach. If you actually were doing what I'm doing, you would chase your clients away. Because most people don't want that. They're not here. In fact, most students don't want that. Most students come to Aikido to get better. They expect a return on this investment. And when I tell them you're not going to get anything, in fact, you've got too much now already, let go of it. That's not always satisfying in the way they thought. It's supremely satisfying, but maybe not always, doesn't always appear to be. But you students, you're all still here. So you clearly see through this. Or you're here. You have rationalized it for some other reason.
Well, Sensei, is there an answer to the chapter title question, who does it? Is it a question? It is a question. Who does it?
You can know this. I can know this. It can be known. It is known. If you say, if you identify it in some way, you won't be right.
If you say I.
Yeah.
Well, I do it.
That's. I would understand, but whatever word we use is misleading. If I say, I could say, if I say Taiga does it, or the unborn one does it, or the universal self does it. These are all things that might naturally occur to us when you read, like, who is the one that's important to be doing it? The answer to that question are things like
the Atma,
universal self. Yeah. Okay.
Non-dual.
But you can see how that's. We could say that's accurate.
It's not gratifying.
But is it accurate to everyone in the room, or everyone who listens to this, or everyone who reads this? Is it accurate? Or do you think that that is separate from the relative agents that run your life? In other words, do you think mind is separate from body, or emptiness is separate from form? If you do, that's not it.
Well, could you not say that was the condition of sleep? To believe that separateness and to believe...
The condition of sleep?
Yeah.
You don't mean literally sleeping at night?
Sleeping.
Sleeping as opposed to waking up.
Mechanical, habituated.
Yeah.
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 And the one who's awake is that you're referring to. The one who,
the answer, there's another word. So Prakash is saying, okay, the answer to who does it is the one who is awake. Well, it's like, that's the universal self. That's the unborn one. That's the Atman. That's the, yeah? The original mind. Our true nature is the awake one, the Buddha. Yeah, but it's not exclusive of anything in the universe. The Christians have so much trouble because they say, well, there's God there, but then there's this Satan. And what am we supposed to do with Satan? Like, he's against God. No, if God is God, then God is everything. If God is great, then he's everything. So it includes everything. There's nothing left out. For the universal self means universal. So every experience, every thought, every sensation, every emotion is part of the universal self, part of the awake being. It's not like we wake up and then we don't have any more thoughts, don't have any emotions, right? And don't have any more, we can't see, feel, hear, touch, or taste. No, on the contrary. All those senses, in fact, all those things are heightened. The clarity of thought, the profoundness of emotion, which suddenly can become a deep sense of compassion and joy instead of anguish and anxiety, a deep sense of emotion, and a heightened sense of awareness in terms of your a tactile and sense organs. So everything becomes intensified, and not only isn't excluded, and not only isn't left behind or killed or denied or put away in some way, but it's enhanced. We get to see it for what it is and experience it in its fullness. That means, as Suzuki Sensei would say, we get to live life completely, instead of partially, or not at all. An argument can be made for not living life at all if you're not aware of what's going on.
Since is there common levels, like awareness? I mean, does... Of course, I would assume that it comes in, like, not one time you're just there, or does it come in levels of, it comes in levels.
Did you mean here? We always think it's somewhere else. It's this.
Yeah.
It's very straightforward. It's just this.
Yeah. Well, at times, say...
You have that question when you pull yourself away from this. He was talking about. When you make a separation, then you have the curiosity. Let's see, how does this happen exactly? Who are you talking to? Who's asking that question? You are here now. You are having this experience. This is living. It's not something other. So when you find yourself running away off into la-la land, be here now.
I've been getting into writing a lot this past year, as I'm still doing it now, but I've been really I've noticed that I've been putting myself, more myself, like, I don't even know how to really explain it, but I've been putting more of my person into my stories. So it's almost like each character that I create is like a reflection of one of the people in my mind, or one of the people that makes me. And after creating like a chapter, or sometimes even just a paragraph, maybe even a sentence, I've noticed that I've been able to, not exactly, can't exactly understand it very well right now, but I felt like I opened up more to what's going on around me and what's going on right here, right here, and what's happening to me in general. So I was just wondering if this was ever even considered a form of just letting it go, or because...
No, I think that those are two different issues. The idea that you, of course, whatever character you write about is you. How could you otherwise know? Right? No matter how outlandish, it comes from you. So that's one thing. The fact that when you are... Do you like writing?
Yes.
Yeah. When you are when we are engaged in something that we really like, it completely involves, well, let me say it this way, it involves much more of our attention and awareness, and we experience it much more deeply than, say, something we're taking for granted, or it's just a habitual thing, something we don't particularly enjoy. Like even something like weeding or cooking, so when you chop, 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 chop. Lynn's always saying, you're going in to go chop, chop, chop again. Because, you know, it involves lots of repetitive work. It's the same thing. When I'm cooking, I have the same experience. I love to do it, and just everything is just... It's just, I completely lose track of time or myself. That's any time you do anything you really love. So you're having this nice experience. So then the question is, when you're through writing, then what happens? Somehow the one who is experiencing life after you're through writing, you're doing something else. Maybe not the same. Maybe you don't have the same experience. Okay?
Yeah. I just wanted to figure that out. That's the one.
But just keep enjoying it. Just keep enjoying it. Do it. Do it more and more and more. No. Oh. Okay. We're out of time. If everybody's out of questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.